What up, Asymmetry listeners? Just finished an amazing conversation with a world-renowned artist of a level I have never actually had the opportunity or pleasure to speak with. Julien Vaas-André is a modern sculptor, has a background in physics, and is exploring ideas and concepts with his work that really touch on a lot of the organic principles of design and shapes that create the universe that we exist in. And to hear his perspective of art, to hear his perspective of design, to take away some of the concepts of his process was truly inspiring, an absolute opportunity to get to converse with such a talented sculptor and artist. I think you'll enjoy this. It's a very diverse, very in-depth, very serious and intense discussion with somebody that is at the forefront of modern sculpture. And we hope that you guys can take some of this and apply it as you will to your bonsai practice. And it was the first time this creative team has transitioned once since we launched the live streaming platform last year. And the new team had never gotten to play with the mics, and all of them wanted to start freestyling. So
Sure. Yeah,
it's kind of awesome. Natural, right?
It is natural.
Can you freestyle?
No. I'm German. I'm struggling with the language as it is.
How, Yeah. I mean, how long have you been in the United States?
18 years.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And still, I mean, you have a little bit of an accent, but it...
Yeah.
Why did you come to the United States?
I was always going to say there was no wall, but I didn't say that. So I said I came because of this woman who then became my wife. I followed her. We fell in love, and I was kind of at a point where I didn't feel like continuing what I was doing. I was in physics at that time,
right?
And so I basically came and started with art, which was something I always had wanted to do before already.
Yeah. How do you say your last name correctly?
Julien Vaas-André.
Vaas-André.
Yeah, or it depends. My mother and my father even pronounce it differently.
Oh, really?
In German. Uh-huh. So there's millions of ways, at least three different ways.
Where in Germany were you?
Hamburg.
Okay.
That's where I come from originally. I studied in Berlin for many years, and yeah, mostly Berlin the last years.
And your background is in physics originally when you were in Germany. What led you to physics?
Well, I was always really intrigued by nature and by natural sciences. And when I was a kid, I read these like popular science magazines, you know, with Einstein and relativity and, you know, these pictures with distorted clocks and stuff. And so I was always really intrigued by that. And at the same time, I had these like sciencey and artsy hobbies. Mm-hmm. And when I was, I don't know, 19 or 20, I felt that if I don't do it now, and I got really into, oh yeah, that's right. I actually attended some philosophy of science classes in university in Berlin because I didn't really know what I was wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And so I came across this book called The Emperor's New Mind, which is about quantum physics and artificial intelligence and how these might or might not go together. And so I was really intrigued by reading again about like the weirdness of modern physics, especially quantum physics, that I kind of decided to really, I want to hear it from the horse's mouth. You know, I want to do those experiments because those are such mind-boggling claims that I felt it's kind of critical to check this for yourself in a way. And so I started and enrolled and then stuck with it for like 8 years and ended up in a research lab that does that exact work, you know, look really at the foundations of quantum physics.
And it says the research lab that you were working with, you guys were doing those kind of quantum physics studies on the largest particles at that time that research was being done on?
With this experiment where I was fortunate enough to do my graduate research in was basically a double-slit experiment, which means you send some sort of particle through a screen with two holes and see them interfere at the end. Mm-hmm. showing the wave behavior. And that was done only, has been done with electrons and molecules for like many decades. But this was kind of a big leap towards buckyballs, which are like 60 carbon atoms and arranged like a soccer ball. And so we used those particles because technology had just come to the point that you could pull that off.
Is physics still limited by technology's capacity?
All the time.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So you think as technology continues to advance, then the field of quantum physics and exploration is going to continue to innovate?
I mean, the best case in point is like Einstein and Bohr were like thought, and Heisenberg, they were doing thought experiments. And the major ones of those thought experiments back then to illustrate how crazy quantum physics is were really done in the 70s and 80s for the first time, in the 90s. So that was like, that took like basically 80, 90 years to get to the point that you could technologically pull off what people had thought about for a long time. Mm. You know, so, but you need to check those things, of course.
Yeah.
We didn't have the computing power.
Yeah, now we can actually gather data and make incredible statistics, which also is another new thing. Yeah. But laser is one of the major things. Laser, and then the semiconductor technology, not only because of the computers, but also in our example, for example, we could make freestanding double slits or like a grating using that exact technology that is made to use to make chips.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's a kind of a big synergy thing.
Right. Now, from your background in physics, you come to the United States. You studied at the Pacific Northwest College of Art.
Yes, that's right.
And what, were your parents involved in art? Were your parents involved in physics? Like, how did you get into physics and then transition to art?
That's a good question. My parents are totally into art. My father is into painting and music, and they're kind of very old-fashioned European cultural kind of people. And my mother has a knack for math, but is not really interested in science a whole lot, but reading about nutrition and stuff like this in general. My father is completely, couldn't care less about science. He was actually, I meant to study art. I went to Berlin with a goal to enroll to the art academy there. And I gave that up and enrolled in physics. And he was trying to talk me out of it because he thought, why would anybody do such a boring and cold thing as technology? He doesn't even, for him, it's not even like there's science and there's technology. For him, it's all one thing. It's kind of boring and lifeless.
Right. Huh. And are they still back in Germany?
They are, yes.
All right. Do you go back frequently?
Yeah, pretty frequently. Like once a year or so, I try to.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. And so when you came here to the United States, you followed love, you come to the United States,
yes.
and you transitioned from physics to art because you'd lost the passion for physics?
I started looking around and thought maybe I can do some research here, but there was nothing that was intriguing. And at the same time, I always knew, you know, I had been doing drawing and printmaking before I did physics. So I knew that I want to become an artist. That was kind of clear to me since I was 18 or 19, but without having any clue what that actually entails.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like, okay, now I finally can tackle that and get on with that. And then I was pretty disappointed to see that painting and printmaking wasn't really interesting to me anymore.
Right.
So it wasn't that I had lost the passion for physics, but it was more that I felt, okay, I have this on my bucket list, basically. And so I did this, and then I fell into sculpture very quickly, and it went from there.
What was it about sculpture that appealed to you?
That's another really funny thing. I really never liked sculpture so much when I was younger, and I never could relate to it. And what happened was that in the final months of my research, I was tasked to look how can we go beyond the buckyballs towards larger, ideally biomolecules, because the goal is you want to send a philosopher through this double slit experiment, you know, somebody who can tell you what the hell is going on here.
Right.
So, but the next step towards the philosopher from the buckyball would be maybe a small biomolecule. At that time, we were thinking of viruses, and a virus sounds small to most people, but for physicists, that's a gigantic thing. So we looked into what is a virus made of. Turns out it's made out of proteins. And all this stuff I had no idea about. As a physicist, you don't learn those things. And so I looked into proteins, and I got really intrigued with protein structure, especially with a green fluorescent protein, which is this jellyfish protein, which this woman, you know, who's now my wife, she did neuroscience and she was using this green fluorescent protein as a marker in her research. So I got, and the cool thing is they look like little lanterns, and they are the little things that make these jellyfish glow green in the dark. And they, you can basically take them and put them in another animal, and then that thing glows green in the dark too. But in any case, I was intrigued by them because I could image them as single molecules. So, okay, now I lost my train of thought here. I went a little far. The proteins. And then, so I looked in my in my research, I looked into proteins. And then when we had the first sculpture class, one of the first assignments was to take a piece of lumber and cut it into mitered cuts, compound mitered cuts. Mm-hmm. So that means basically you do a 45-degree angle, flip the piece, and then you have a 90-degree angle. You can glue it back together. You don't lose any material. You turn a one-dimensional thing into essentially a three-dimensional convoluted thing. And when we had the critique of those pieces, I was instantly reminded of proteins, because that's exactly how nature goes from one-dimensional DNA to three-dimensional bodies via proteins, peptide chains that wind up into space in three-dimensional ways. Mm-hmm. So then I set out to write a program that would turn protein structural data into cutting instructions to make mitered cut protein sculptures. And that's how I got into sculpture in a nutshell, because I was really intrigued by that.
Wow. So you met now your current wife, and she was a neuroscientist.
She was at that time doing her PhD in neuroscience.
And you were still a physicist at that time.
Yes.
And you started looking at what she was doing, particularly latching onto this protein that has bioluminescence.
Exactly.
And you're like, the structure of that is phenomenal.
Yes.
And I'm not learning about this, and I want to know more about this.
Exactly.
And so when you came to the United States and you went to the Pacific Northwest College of Arts, your move and drive into sculpture was basically this protein structure and the use of peptide chains and the mitered cut to be able to turn two dimensions into three.
Exactly.
Sculpturally.
I became totally obsessed with that thing and developed it.
Now, I was looking at some of your work and a lot of it really appealed to me. I see a lot of, Rob and I have talked a lot about the potential to take organic forms like a protein or a DNA chain and potentially do larger form sculptures that could house these trees and create a new aesthetic or a new dynamic in terms of not only the aesthetic, but also the way that the trees grow through the structure as a potential idea, right? And using that organic structure as a scaffolding that could create a guide for growth. Which is interesting to think about when you think about, I mean, you're talking about how nature has basically created the structures that one on top of another build the form of any living thing on the planet to some degree or another. You know, one of the things that I'm always curious about is what happens if you continue to replicate that shape of the form. You know, like you look at the Fibonacci sequence and you see this repeated throughout nature and several other conceptual ideas about proportion that are continually and repetitively treated throughout nature. In bonsai, there's a definitive sort of golden rule as well as these sequences and fractal geometry that ties into the way that plants naturally grow and also the aesthetic that appeals to the human mind when it views these things, almost like a release of serotonin that we're, you know, programmed to experience when we witness these proportions and these correct geometries. We try to tamper with that geometry and see what it does to your interpretation of the tree when you view it, because nature's such a random act, particularly when you go on the larger scale. The tree is responding to its environment and the randomness of the environment, particularly as age continues to accumulate. The tree can't stay the idyllic form of optimal photosynthetic productivity, which is the pyramid form for most upright growing conifers. So then all of a sudden, if you continue to mimic that growth habit that is represented in the tree's natural structure of its vascular system, et cetera, what happens? I don't know. Maybe nothing. Maybe it just looks cool, but I'm curious, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of how I approach this too. I mean, I use those things and those ideas and kind of spin them on and see what happens. And I think it's you know, it's, I think you have to strike a balance between being too slavishly, you know, kind of like attached to the idea what this is about, this algorithm. And on the other hand, you know, this all freestyle wouldn't work either, for me at least. So somewhere, like, I like it when there's a feedback happening between, you know, the algorithmic following of an idea and the just saying, hey, I like this, and I don't know why, and I don't really care why.
Mm-hmm. What led you to then the transition from those forms to some of the pieces that I looked at of yours that really appealed to me were the sheets of metal that when you look at it from the side represents a solid form, but then when you look at it from the, you know, the thin side of the metal, you transparently see through your sculptures. How did you cross over? I believe it's called the reader.
There's a number of different works.
Yeah.
And I tend to call them quantum sculptures because from where they come from. When I did proteins, and when I was drawing and painting too, I was very intrigued, always, or mostly intrigued by the human form and by the portrait. And I always felt that this is kind of the key thing for me. And even when I made a protein like the Linus Pauling piece on Hawthorne in Portland, mm-hmm. you know, if you look very carefully, you see that even though it's a repetitive form, it's not really, it's wider on the top than on the bottom. So it does resemble a human standing figure. And that's actually the aspect that intrigued me. So there was always the sense that I want to talk about the human body and the human figure, the human. And not only by using the human's proteins, like in collagen, for example, which is our most abundant protein, but also in the shape. So it was a natural thing for me to do figurative sculpture. But I didn't, partly because I wasn't good at it and I needed to kind of have a reason. So the reason came when I was mentioning the philosopher through the double slit. So that was that image of how would it feel like to be a quantum object going through that experiment and being diffracted, being, you know, superimposed, like basically in a superposition with yourself in a different place. That if you look at the math and you look at an object moving in one direction, then the math tells you that the wave function associated with that object would be consisting out of perpendicular wave fronts, perpendicular to the direction of motion, equally spaced. And so that idea led to that very first walking man. I was envisioning myself as a quantum object, so a walking man would be the natural thing for me, and I consist out of wave fronts in that direction. And that was the first time I made a piece in this style based on that idea, and that was in 2006. And when I was finished, I realized that it fits really well with what this is all about, that the perspective, the view, the appearance shifts drastically depending on your point of view. From the front and back, it looks like solid steel, whereas from that one angle on the side, the piece would almost disappear because mm-hmm. you see only 10% of steel as opposed to 100% of steel. The rest is air in that angle because they're all parallel.
Right.
And then I made a number of pieces in that style, but all based on that walking man image. And in 2012... scanning technology had proceeded to a point that I started using human models as a starting point, as raw data, and with that same idea. And at that point, I shifted that I was more interested in the disappearing effect than in the physics analogy. So I started using the direction of the gaze of my human figure as that disappearing angle. So I started out making a lying female figure looking sideways out, and that's the angle where that piece disappeared. And then I made a whole number of pieces with that same idea.
And so this idea and the first conceptual realization of the idea was 2006.
Yeah.
Are you still building on that idea?
Today, yes.
Yeah.
Still today, yeah.
And
two brand new projects are in the works right now with that same style.
And how does that, when you... I mean, they're very powerful, the pieces that you're creating. And when you strike upon an idea that really has a lot of context and merit like that, how does it work to continue evolving that idea for you? I mean, you change the angle of the steel to align with the gaze. And then where do you go from that as somebody whose work is in demand and people appreciate what you're doing to continue sort of pushing the level of what you're doing or exploring? It seems to me exploration is maybe more your motivation than meeting the economic demands. I don't know.
It's a tricky one, you know, because running a sculpture shop is very expensive. So it's very important to not be completely oblivious about the money aspect
sure.
of things. At the same time, you know, money has a corrosive kind of element to it. And it's like, I don't want, you know, the market forces to drive what I'm doing. So it's kind of important for me to strike a balance. And I don't really know how to think about it, but the only guiding principle I'm using is that I want to be passionate about it. So if I make a piece and I'm not passionate about it, then I basically neglect it.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm excited about it, even if I can't say why, then I'm doing it.
Mm.
Oh.
Such a juggling act, a difficult balance to be able to explore, as, you know, seems to motivate most artists, and juggle that the economics of being able to do so. It's a challenge that, I mean, obviously we're playing with tiny trees, so it's a little different than what you're doing here. But nevertheless, it seems to cross all boundaries of sculpture and art and sort of aesthetic exploration. It's a phenomenal limitation and also a enabling component of it to continue working,
right.
You know? And I find that to be interesting. But the corrosive nature of it is also seems to be very true.
I mean, it's like what you were mentioning with the trees, you know, they try to optimize their, you know, the exposure to the sunlight, and but the thing is, there's these underlying principles that they want to optimize, and that's, you see that everywhere in nature. And then there's also the boundary conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually what gives rise to kind of beauty,
right.
In a way, that interplay.
Right.
You know,
between
inherent like desire or plan and real world kind of boundaries.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think one of the things about bonsai that has appealed to me most is that a lot of people try to impose sort of human desires and intentional actions onto trees, but you also have this perfect system. I mean, you have basically a loss of water in the foliage mass, which is one water molecule is attached to another and another and another, and it forms a chain through the vascular system. And when that water molecule is lost, it applies tension on the chain. That tension on the chain is a chain reaction all the way down to the roots. And when one water molecule is lost, technically, if we look at it as a broad brushstroke, it pulls one water molecule in from the soil, right? And this is how a tree stays hydrated. And mainly the function of water is not growth so much as air conditioning, because you have an immobile object or an immobile living thing that can't go into the shade as a human can to cool themselves. It has to have this system of transpiration or sweating, if you will, to be able to continue to cool itself and maintain cellular functionality to produce sugars and starches from the capturing of the sun's energy, photosynthesis. And so when you look at all of the behavior of a tree, when we get these beautiful, dramatic shapes that come out of the random acts of nature and the boundary constraints of the environment that form this really dramatic shape and this concept of life and death, where the tree has struggled for hundreds of years and it's been limited with its resources. And this is over 300, 400, 500 years. It's still this very small tree because that's all the resources that it had to grow. And there's a lot of dead on it because those pieces didn't make it in the process. You have this asymmetry and this conceptual representation of age that is based on the randomness of this environment. But when you bring it into domesticated cultivation and we care for it and we water it and we fertilize it, it inherently moves back to that optimal photosynthetic shape naturally, because it has all the resources that it needs to once again be young. And every tree is governed by the hormonal allocation of resources that drive that optimal productivity of shape. So it's like this, once we take this really asymmetrical, dramatic form and we put it into an environment that facilitates optimal growth, it moves back to the optimal shape to maximize its productivity. And it's not a choice that the tree is making. The tree is just responding to whatever the restraints are, whether it's surviving in a harsh environment or whether it's thriving in this domesticated environment. And that shift is also very interesting to look at, because then you start to say, oh, how do you work with the system? And I think Bonsai to date has been a little bit archaic, because I think it's been a process of working against the system to try and make the tree do what you want. But there's also a beautiful way to work with the system, if you understand it, to be able to encourage the tree to potentially push farther on those areas where that drama asymmetry and sort of randomness of that environment is still reflected, even though it's in a domestic situation now. And that's really sort of at the very base of what we're trying to do here is figure out how we use the system that drives the survivability of trees to continue to explore aesthetic boundaries. And that's more the science of it coming into just the physiology of the plant's behavior than it is the design desires of having it look a certain way. You know, can you use the physiology to drive aesthetic more than use sort of your interpretation to drive the aesthetic? And it's a wonderful exploration. I saw similarities in your work, just in sort of the way you're exploring these concepts and representing them aesthetically. You're using the concept to drive the form, and that's I'm very inspired by that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, it's so odd. Why are we drawn to those kind of shapes? You know, it's like a 19th century painting, this romantic nature, but it really does something in us, and I'm not able to say why, but it's very strong.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the best things we did, so we have Mirai Live, which is we teach bonsai online, we live stream, and then we have a library of videos that people can refer to learn different species, different aesthetic approaches, different techniques, you know, sort of the gauntlet of information to practice bonsai well. And when we started doing it, the people that started giving us feedback and contributing and playing a role in the evolution of this platform come from all professional careers, walks of life, thought processes, etc. And it's been such a incubator for ideas as to the aesthetics, the technique, the potential inspiration, but also a lot of these farther out concepts of like fractal geometry came from a mathematician that is practicing bonsai and said, hey, this is a real thing that's happening here. Have you guys ever looked at this? And we were just like,
for sure.
You know,
it's actually pretty obvious if you look at it.
Yeah. Right. And that's the weird thing. I feel like when you look at really well executed art and design, a lot of it does feel obvious once you see it. But it's not so obvious to conceptualize it, right? It takes a lot of digging, and clearly you've had to dig a lot. Your background in physics is very much that painstaking amount of education and experimentation with quantum physics is driving your sculptural work now, or at least contributing to it in a big way, it seems.
Yeah.
Without that, what work would you be making? I mean, that's also an interesting question.
Yeah, it is. I have no idea. It's, for me, it's just like a natural continuation of what I loved as a kid. You know, I like to read about nature and be in nature and look at sand grains and stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just kind of the same thing.
Yeah. I read somewhere that if you put a cue ball under, this is a total tangent, but I read somewhere where if you put a cue ball under a microscope, or maybe who's the physicist that is always talking about Mars and space travel and...
Carl Sagan?
Not Carl Sagan.
That's what I thought it was.
It'll come to me in a minute. Anyways, he was saying that it would be far more contoured than the surface of the Earth if it was blown up to scale.
A what would you put under the microscope?
A cue ball, a pool cue ball.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that if you analyze it under
it
a microscope.
It has higher ups and downs. The amplitudes. Yeah, I can believe that, actually.
That's...
Yeah. I mean, if you think about how big the Earth is and the biggest... It's like 10,000 meters is the Mount Everest, a little less than that. It's like nothing, you know?
Yeah.
For like...
At the scale.
Like 6,000 kilometers, the diameter.
Yeah.
The radius, yeah.
When I was a kid, they said that Kansas is in fact flatter than a pancake.
Right.
If you blew it up, it reminded me of that with the cue ball. If you blew it up to the size of Earth, it would have higher mountains than Everest. Anyways, it's very interesting. Another one of your works that I looked at that that was super interesting to me. It's a black sculpture of a human figure out in a sort of a grassy field at a private residence. Is that, it has a name.
It's called Samantha in the Meadows.
Samantha in the Meadows.
Yeah.
So it's, Samantha is made of what looked like almost like a star-like structure that was repeated through it.
What it actually is it's a space-filling tessellation of irregular tetrahedra. So imagine you take a human shape and render it as like as a polyhedron with like only triangular faces. Okay, so we can make that. And I made sculptures like this, and then you can extend this triangular skin into tetrahedra that fill the interior of the solid. And that's something that engineers do all the time. They call it finite element analysis. It's one of the tricks of basically solving their differential equations for complex solids. So if you have a bridge and you don't just want to know if it collapses on its own, but also see what happens when when it waves in the wind, then you need to do that.
Because you're able to see the stresses that are
exactly.
put on the different...
And you can do time resolved. You can put heat on it, or you can put it in summer or winter. You can do all the physics by basically subdividing the bridge or whatever it is into small solids. And it has been a good approach to use tetrahedra because they're irregular, because they have to. You can't tessellate space with regular tetrahedra. So that doesn't bias the whole thing. And you can go smaller where it's more complex and where the stuff happens. So in a nutshell, these algorithms are there and I just use them as a raw material for my design. Those engineering algorithms.
An algorithm as a raw material.
Yeah.
Wow. And you chose to make that structure black.
It's very dark, yeah.
Very dark.
It's bronze. It's a dark patina.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose to patina it dark?
I wanted like a drawing. You know,
like a line drawing or something.
Yeah.
And I mean, out in the meadow where it's placed,
yes,
it looks very haunting.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's quite an experience to be there because it's a very big place and it's a very wide open space. And she's 10 feet tall, so she's not small.
She's 10 feet tall.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was much taller than that.
No, she's quite big. One interesting aspect is that the tetrahedra, it's all the struts basically. They're moving from half inch on the bottom to a diameter of about a quarter inch. So there's a subtle change going from the bottom to the top. But it's one of those pieces that don't make a whole lot of sense on a photo, but really kind of when you walk around them, kind of assembles in your brain. As an entity somehow.
Yeah. And is the half inch on the bottom to the quarter inch on top, is that a structural consideration?
It sort of helps structurally, but I made a piece where I just used this tapering, even though it's a pain fabrication-wise, but it made all the difference to me. I mean, look at a tree or any sculpt thing in nature. They all do that.
Yes.
You know, they never stick with the same diameter anywhere.
Right.
And so it was just somehow an obvious thing to do.
Yeah. And when you're making pieces like this, the engineering that has to go into a 10-foot tall structure like that has got to be significant, I would imagine.
In this case, I knew it doesn't get stronger than tetrahedra, you know, because that's all triangulated.
Right.
So I was like, I knew this was going to work structurally. I did other pieces where I needed some finite element analysis engineering in order to see how little steel can I get away with.
Right. And... In your work, do you ever desire to push the degree of the material limitation?
Always.
Always.
There's never a work where that doesn't do that.
Uh-huh.
Well, there's a few that don't do it a whole lot. But basically, every time we build something new in the shop, we just don't really know how it's going to work out.
Right.
Like right now, we're building a piece in this quantum slicer style of two people pushing way well beyond life size, maybe, I don't know, eight feet tall or so. And they have these very flimsy feet, you know, the four legs. That's just not a whole lot of steel. And we have a support structure, and at the end we'll take it off and see what happens.
What if it collapses?
Then I'm in trouble.
How long does one of these pieces take you?
It really depends. They have taken from 3 years to like 3 months.
Aha. The more that you refine a concept and become familiar with the nuances of executing the concept, are you able to do it faster, or is that not necessarily a correlation?
It does go by a factor of maybe 1.5 faster after a while. But the thing is that's typical for an addition, because then it's actually the same. But usually, if I figure something out, I kind of push my limit again and do something crazy in addition. You know, that's how it kind of keeps going.
Right.
So there's always something kind of worrisome and new.
What do you think that is? That is inside of you to continue pushing further in terms of limitation? Because you could explore any number of forms and shapes within a comfortable realm of limitation, yet you choose to continue to sort of dabble on that boundary of potential failure.
I really don't know why that is. I mean, I have a suspicion, you know, this, we all humans, we all have, you know, it's always kind of, we have to deal with this whole thing, being alive and then not be there anymore at some point. So it's kind of a convenient thing to always keep yourself busy, for sure.
Mm.
So that's maybe part of it.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it's just exciting to do new things.
Yeah.
And kind of boring to do the same thing.
Right.
So
what's it like seeing your work in very public spaces and watching people interact with it?
It's pretty fun.
Is it?
Yeah.
Do you ever just randomly go to look at the pieces that are in public spaces and sort of watch the way that people interact and respond to it?
Yeah, I do that a little bit. I used to do that more. Now I don't really.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what I just went to Grand Rapids and had a piece there, a 10-foot tall, pretty gigantic piece, like almost 2 tons of stainless. And I had actually people, I encouraged them. I was there for like several days and told them they can sit on the lap of the sculpture and can take photos as if they were like, as if they're floating, because, you know, at the right angle, when you do it right, then they seem to be floating in the air. And people really, really loved that.
Mm.
And that was actually really fun, because it's just, you're in your shop and you do your thing on the computer and you don't get out a whole lot. And if you actually see how these works then do something to people, and it's a very positive thing. It's a kind of a reward that you don't expect at all.
Do you feel like your pieces generate in the viewer the same curiosity that you felt, or is that a motivation for you with the work that you put out there? I mean, you talked about your fascination with nature as a kid and sort of this desire to be able to understand physics and be able to execute these concepts that led you into physics. You feel like your pieces have that kind of impact on people?
That's what some people say also online, but that's not really what I'm trying to do. It's not like at OMSI, like a science museum where I'm trying to illustrate concepts. For me, it's like really about this aspect of wonder, which is like the core of all our research and interest in nature and in life. You know, we wonder first. And that's something I definitely want to have people experience.
Mm-hmm.
The true ideas come from is that moment of wonder and curiosity.
Right.
Yeah. Right. It's kind of what drives the whole, all of science. In order to be a good scientist, you got to wander and let your mind go to places that may not be normal.
Right. Yeah.
You
not yet normal.
Yeah, not yet.
What is normal? Do you feel like, or have you seen people take your concepts and manipulate them in a different way, or take your concepts and duplicate them?
Yes.
How do you feel about that?
It's a mix, you know. I mean, it depends how it's done. I mean, I had all sorts of examples from excited people who do something like this, and I'm fully supportive of that. Also with the proteins, I have it was actually a website a guy wrote with a plugin that would allow you could just download any data and then it would give you the cutting instructions. You can make your own protein sculpture, and I'm super supportive of that because it's really fun.
Mm-hmm.
And with the slices, it's a bit difficult sometimes. I mean, there were like many like well-meaning ones, but I had at least one example of people who made a large public sculpture without crediting, just exactly took my style and made a big piece, and that's of course frustrating after you've put over a decade of, you know, of your labor and of your vision and, you know, also your sanity into it. You know, that's of course frustrating. But on the other hand, I mean, I fully realize that many of the things I do are happening because they are out there. It's like, you know, technology moves on, our cultural like language visual language moves on, and there's 3D printing. So these concepts become, oh yeah, that's obvious suddenly, you know, but even though they weren't obvious maybe a few years ago.
Right.
So it's, you know, it's just part of the time too, the cultural evolution.
And are there artists or work out there beyond sort of the forms that you're pulling from on that sort of protein level where all of this started? But are there artists whose work has inspired or informed your work?
Not really. I know there's like at least maybe, well, not much, but maybe two people. One is dead now, but they used proteins to make structures that went beyond the model aspect and aimed at it like an art kind of experience. And that this was kind of a pretty separate approach. They have very different approaches. And so I've never seen, for example, the miter cut ideas, which was the thing that was intriguing to me mostly.
Mm-hmm.
No, there's not so much in the world of art science. You know, that's only happening in the past few years.
Mm-hmm.
When I started that, I was a complete oddball person in the early 2000s, pretty much, compared to now.
Do you feel like 3D printing is what's sort of opening the door to that, or is there not a correlation there necessarily?
I don't really know. I mean, 3D printing, I mean, it's interesting. 3D printing is associated with maker movement, which is something that has always happened but didn't have a name, and now it's like its own, you know, wave.
They really did.
I mean, it's related, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, I mean, it's clearly one of the major ingredients that's a new day for sculpture today.
Like, right.
Stuff is different.
Right. Do you embrace that enabling that the 3D printing movement has provided to sculpture?
Completely.
Yeah, you love it?
Absolutely.
And
same with scanning, by the way.
Yeah.
That's the other big ingredient.
Right. I mean, Rob was up here and he was saying that maybe now we're aware or capable of using 1% of the potential of 3D printing just because we can't, our minds have not yet been able to wrap sort of our intelligence around or understanding of what is actually possible with 3D printing and scanning, as you said. And that's another thing Rob really pushed is quality of the scan and the information that you can take in is what enables the evolution and advancement.
No, I feel the same. We just have a glimpse, a taste of it right now.
Right.
I mean, everything will eventually be produced 3D printed, I think.
Think so?
Yeah.
It's been interesting to see sort of the bioform find its way into architecture as well. It seems to be at the basis for the current architectural movement, or at least a lot of the concepts around the current architectural movement. And it's fascinating, but just like you're saying, the tetrahedral structure is so structurally sound that you knew that Samantha and the Meadow would work. And when you apply it in a grander scale to architecture, it does allow a lot of innovative forms to start to take place and to really push the built environment into what was thought to be impossible structurally.
No question, yeah.
And then as far as the materials, I mean, are you seeing an advancement in the use of materials or what is being utilized or the possibility for new materials to be utilized that could usurp steel or some of the current materials that have become the backbone of more modern sculpture?
Well, I'm kind of a steel guy, but not so much. Well, I like steel, but it's like there's very few things that hold up against gravity and the weather outside.
Mm.
That's basically steel, stainless steel, maybe bronze and titanium. That's kind of about it.
Mm-hmm.
And also, where's technology that, you know, is developed enough that we can actually build it?
Right.
You know, and thanks to the wars, we have welding and all the steel technology. And it's just, I don't really see, I like simple materials that are actually, that okay, that's steel, I can get that.
Mm-hmm.
If it's like composite material and I don't know what it does after 20 years, it doesn't age gracefully, it kind of brittles and decays and grays.
Right.
You know, that's not appealing to me.
Yeah. So the decomposition of your forms over the course of time, not something you're interested in the exploration of?
Well, I've done a few things that were like looking into that. Like I made a hemoglobin protein actually that was in a weathering steel, and it was all about installing it shiny and then taking photos, how it rusts basically, mm-hmm. and does what hemoglobin essentially does, oxygen and iron combining.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but most for the most part, I like to adhere to that illusion that there is something in the world that is not temporal.
Right. Oh, that's very interesting. I mean, we have to deal with the impermanence of bonsai because they can die at any minute, which unfortunately is an experience that every bonsai practitioner has to come to grips with and become comfortable with. You pour all that love and effort into a tree, and unfortunately the random acts that created the dramatic form can continue to create more deadwood and more dramatic forms. So that impermanence is something that I've had to become very comfortable with in my medium. But the other thing that I'm really curious about is when you put a piece out into the world, contextually, a lot of people probably don't have the background of where your motivations came from and what inspired that exploration and experimentation. So you put this piece out there and people look at it and they form an opinion about it without context. And we as a team have had a lot of discussions about this, about how art, when you do put it out there, you sort of sacrifice that ability to say, this is what I was trying to do. You know, that literal connection to let me explain. And is there value in being able to provide that context so that the viewer can get the full scope of the intelligence, experience, pain, time, work, labor, effort that you've put in? Or do you think it's more valuable for them to just take whatever impression, maybe a small percentage of people will actually dig and understand what went into it? How do you feel about that in your work and people having the context or not to view it and understand it?
Well, I always have kind of the desire that this work speaks for itself, which is, you know, of course, not really true, because there's always the cultural background, you know, and if you show this piece to an alien, you know, they're probably not find it so great because they're just lacking all that baggage.
Right.
And but on the other hand, I mean, I'm kind of opposed to like these pieces that only work because there's an artist statement on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
So it's somewhere in between. I think it's basically icing on the cake. You know, if there's this conceptual underpinning and that's intriguing and that kind of carries the piece at a certain point, that's great. But I think the most important thing is that it's intriguing and you know, and wonderful.
You think there are aliens?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you don't think they'd like your work?
I'm striving for that, actually.
Okay.
I didn't only mean it as a joke. You know, I would like to make a piece that an alien likes too.
Yeah.
Maybe they have more baggage.
Maybe
their baggage is,
for sure,
pushes them to, I think they would like it. I also think there's aliens, and I think they would like your work.
Well, if there's one out there, I would like to scan one, and then we can make one based on Alien Buddy.
Yeah.
Awesome. I would love that.
I mean, do you feel like that curiosity about life outside of Earth directly correlates with physics? I mean, does your belief in aliens come from your physics background?
You know, I've changed that drastically like only a year ago or so. And in physics, you typically don't find many people who think UFOs, extrasensory perception, telekinesis, and aliens are anything should consider. You know, so but there's weird stuff out there, and I think it's easier as a non-physicist, which I am now, to have an open mind.
Mm.
Did that kind of answer the question?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So almost like as a physicist, you're constantly trying to prove it.
As a physicist, you're so into your paradigm and into your world, in the world of logical reasoning. You know, you write this grant and you write that paper and you write it down all like seamlessly logical. There is almost like, it feels like there's no space, not a lot of space for the bizarre stuff. Mm-hmm. There's a few, of course, exceptions of great minds that are able and interested in going into those boundaries, into those gray zones.
Is there information that you've seen? I mean, you said that shift is within the past year. Was there something that happened that you were like, you know,
I just talk with people, and then I bought a whole bunch of books, and I just like got really interested in it.
Very cool.
I think it's a statistical probability. I don't know.
Yeah, see, I know Lyme has like...
I have a very founded...
You're talking about the Drake equation?
Well, not so much that. It's just you think of the universe, the size of the universe, and you worked in quantum mechanics. There had, you know, the probability that something else out there has to happen, to me, it has to.
Right. There's people who say that. That's the Drake equation. Yeah, that basically, it's an equation that says, that puts in all the parameters, yeah, basically by guessing them, and then saying, here's the statistical likelihood that they are aliens.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, we really don't know any of these things that we need to know.
The parameters.
For example, how likely is it that life happens? What even, we can't even imagine any other life but ours. How could we even start to really make a meaningful assumption there? On the other hand, my feeling is the same.
But we have to somewhere try to make that. That's where the wonder is, you know, and I like to wander in that wondering world that, oh, this is my equation that I put together, the statistical probability that this happened.
Yeah.
You know, the probability that parallel dimensions exist. I mean, we're in this reality where we're looking at things that we see, this physical, but what is happening beyond that? What says that the energy that we're dealing with isn't interacting on a parallel universe? I don't know, you know, and to close that off, I think would be hindering to creativity. So yeah. Keeping the possibility that those alternate realities or dimensions happen is, I think, important to keep my mind working. You know, I'd struggle with quantum mechanics. It can be frustrating sometimes, you know, but then again, there's now data, you know. There's a lot of usable data, and that's kind of what pushed me into a lot of the probability that there has to be something. Doesn't mean it does, because it could be nothing, you know. The probability that it's nothing is there. So, yeah.
Yeah, it is.
On my tangent there.
Nice. Do you ingest other mediums of art or design, or are there, you know, beyond sculpture?
I'm not really that much of an art looker person. You know, I had this kind of weird experience when I was all into drawing and I was really young. I would like surround myself with lots of images and pictures, and I had a feeling that kind of screwed me over in my mind. Mm. It's like there was so much there, and I would compare, and I enjoy to have a kind of like to not know a whole lot, but that's of course impossible. You go to the art fairs and you see stuff on Instagram. So right. You're exposed to it anyway.
Right.
Especially these days.
Yeah. And do you feel like in the current era of social media and the expansion of, I mean, the enabling and also potentially debilitating capacity of the internet, that it's impossible to be an artist without utilizing those resources or those components?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
More and more impossible.
Yeah. So when you're working in your studio and you're creating these pieces, how many people are you working with?
Right now, we have a crew of about five that does most of the fabrication.
Yeah. And is it hard for you to find the type of person that can execute the work at the level that you want and are aspiring to?
It's, you know, like basically when you're... It's really tricky to be a boss and an employer mm-hmm. and have employees and get that right. And I've been struggling with this for many years now. And I'm trying to do the right thing. Now we're at a point where I've like two people who have been working with me for almost 4 years now. And it feels really good right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it has not always been like this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of surprising how difficult it is actually, because you think, you know, you typically think of yourself, you're easygoing and you're kind of straightforward, but people are very different, have very different styles. And it's a huge learning curve.
Yeah. 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 Boy, I sympathize.
It's like having kids almost, you know,
yeah,
because you think you know everything, but you don't.
Yeah. Do you have children?
Yeah.
Do any of your interactions or relationships with your children inform your work at all?
Yes, I actually often seek out their advice for new ideas.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
The reader you mentioned before was actually an idea of one of my children.
Cool.
One said a book and the other one said a light bulb or something like this. But the light bulb didn't go through. That became a glass sphere that didn't go through the proposal stage.
Huh. Very, very cool. And as far as when you originally started, were you doing all of the fabrication?
Yes.
And as you've transitioned and your work is known, appreciated, and in demand, Do you have any sort of remorse around the loss of having your hands?
No.
No?
My hands are in the computer the whole time.
Right.
You know, so I basically get better at what I do. And the people I work with, they're so incredibly good at welding and doing the metalwork. They're by now much better than me.
Right.
You know, so it used to be that I could say like, hey, well, let me show you. It's like, that's over.
And for you, you're totally comfortable with that.
I am, because it's all for me about the final product. It's mm-hmm. about sculpture is always more or less obviously or like hidden, but it's always teamwork, you know, has always been. There's mm-hmm. no sculpture that has been like carved alone somewhere. I mean, or barely none. I mean, if you Rodin or who you mention anybody, it's basically a whole team of people, often unknown. And I, you know, it's that's another struggle. You know, of course, you know, I try to, you know, make this teamwork and also say that this is about the teamwork. But on the other hand, the realities of the art world are such that, you know, this is not always talked about.
Yeah, yeah, your name is put
right.
And is that difficult to manage in terms of your team feeling as though they have credit for the effort that they've put in?
It has been in the yeah. past. You know, right now it's pretty good, and I'm working on basically involving also the team in the design stage more, which is, you know, something I'm also happy to do. It's just also not an easy thing because it's not always doable,
sure,
but as far as possible, I'm trying to strive for that,
yeah,
acknowledging that it's really yeah. a team effort.
Well, but just the same as you're saying, you can no longer pick up a tool and say, let me show you how to do that better. It seems like if you're putting in the kind of time and thought and ultimately generating the ideas that are creating these forms, that it would be hard for them to pick up
yes.
that tool and show you how to do
for
it better.
Sure. But yeah. but there's also this kind of engineering borderland mm-hmm. where we kind of just talk about how can we pull this off? Or I have an idea for a gesture, for example. And then we just talk about how can this structurally be done? And this is always interesting, you know, or just the nitty gritty of building a piece, making it real, is so complex that that in itself informs the design. So it's not like separate. There's not the design and we pull it off somehow. This is a very connected, you know, a path.
Do you feel that the more you allow the team to do their part and you focus on your part, the pieces have become more powerful? The more you allow everyone to run down their alleyways and get stronger?
Well, I think it's important I'm trying to get rid of feeling responsible for every aspect of it, because right. I think that's the only way towards growth. You know, right. that I know, okay, I trust that they can do this really well. You know, so I, in that sense, they have clearly become more powerful, because just technology or technique wise, they've been gone a long ways over the yeah. past 10 years at least.
Yeah. Right.
You know, every year we innovate a whole bunch of new things and you can see it in the works.
Yeah. Well, like that.
It's such a slippery slope from the perspective of it seems anyways. I mean, I experienced this here stylistically. I think we have a nuance that makes our work a little different than other bonsai. And pulling in new ideas and how those new ideas fit into sort of the ethos of the design or the work that we do here has always been not, I wouldn't say it's a challenge. I mean, I think it's a challenge if you choose to look at it without challenge being a negative term, because it can always contribute to a much better, more powerful idea. And we obviously are the product of all of the things that we take in this environment. As you're saying, you looked at so many paintings and drawings and it almost tainted your mind to conceptualizing, because you have all this other information that's sort of maybe blocking or influencing your thought process. And I would think that particularly for your work, because you do have concepts and a very stylistic approach that is unique to you, that working with people longer and longer so they understand those nuances that make your work specific to your studio and your team and your concepts, that length would almost be necessary so that everybody's on the same page. Is that kind of what you've experienced?
I think that's true. I mean, this goes down to the level of how do you do stuff. You know, we try to we're working on that right now, actually, to have like best practices, kind of like how it should be done. So we're all kind of on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
And I it's always also important, I think, to have people. Typically, many we work alone on one piece, but often we mix it up, and it's always really interesting and good to have like different teams,
mm-hmm.
sub teams, basically that learn from each other.
Are you producing multiple pieces at one time?
Yes.
Is that hard to shift from piece to piece when you're trying to?
It is hard. I mean, in the fabrication stage, it's its own animal because that can be organized. But mentally, I'm kind of start getting confused sometimes when I work on several proposals at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But I tend to latch onto one and do it fully, and then I'm done with that, and mm-hmm. then I go to the next one. So it feels always like that I have one main one in my mind.
Mm-hmm. It's that, like in the foreground, like this.
Yeah.
But you've got.
I need to figure that out, kind of.
Yeah. And what does your process look like in terms of you get a proposal, somebody wants a piece. Do you start with a theme? Do you have an idea that you pitch in terms of, I'm thinking about this. What do you think? How does that work for you?
I typically like to visit the site if it's already built.
Mm-hmm.
And then I spend like many hours there and just wait till something emerges in me. And then I kind of see how, you know, the space would benefit from that. And then it kind of crystallizes. And sometimes I know it right away, and sometimes it takes like hours.
Mm-hmm.
And then I take enough photos and plans and directions and all that stuff that I can reconstruct it at home.
Mm-hmm.
So I can basically then change my mind, but I have everything, all the data I need to make it work.
And have you ever had a location or a project that's just truly stumped you, where you, as opposed to the normal of immediately several hours, it just hasn't come?
Yeah, I just don't pursue it then.
Really? So if you go to a place or you're proposed with a project and nothing comes from it, for you, that's the moment where you step away from that.
Yeah.
Because you need to be inspired by that project.
Right, exactly.
Huh.
Yeah. But it's typically, this is like, there's this gray zone where they don't say, hey, you get all this money to make this piece. It's like, you know, that you meet people and you travel there maybe, and you might get a proposal fee paid, but it's like, kind of non-committal at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So if it fizzles out, it fizzles out, you know.
Mm-hmm. But in terms of, have you ever had a project where it was a go and you simply, the idea didn't happen for you?
No, I don't think so.
No. Wow. Wow. Do you feel, have you ever had to work harder to generate an idea or to draw the connection to the piece with the space?
I don't work harder. I just wait longer then.
Just wait longer.
Yeah.
I like that.
Because I know it's not, I can't push it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if I learned anything over those years, 14 or years or whatever I'm doing this, is to kind of be good about, okay, this will solve itself. And now I need to stress about this. Kind of go with the waves, basically. That's kind of the key thing.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you juggle so many things at the same time and you kind of like, you're sort of in control, because if you don't do it, it doesn't happen. You know, so that's kind of a workflow that you'd have to learn over years.
Yeah. How did you learn all of this, though? I mean, because you, when you came here 18 years ago and you started art school, well, how long did it take before you were producing the kind of pieces where people were like, you know, this guy's onto something?
It was the first piece I sold shortly after, that was probably, I was still in college, but that was for a price tag that's not a living wage.
Right.
So the first time I actually was able to enter those kind of spheres there, that was 3 years after I graduated. And that was pretty much exactly the time I gave myself, because I don't like to fool myself. And
mm-hmm.
I wanted to see, is this workable or not? You know, this would be fun and I want to do this, but I'm not going to kill myself. If it doesn't work, then I'm just going to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking of opening a burrito shop.
Oh.
But I never had to do that.
The world is a better place with your sculptures than
my
burritos.
Burritos would be pretty darn good too.
Would they be good? Are you a burrito connoisseur?
Yeah, I love burritos.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. What's your burrito of choice?
Well, I make actually vegan burritos.
Uh-huh.
And that's really, really intriguing to me.
Josh is our resident vegan.
Right on.
Yeah.
Also love burritos. Literally any burrito shop, if there's an option of what to eat when we're out as a team working, Josh is going to push hard for the burrito.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah, that's funny.
In a way, it's the perfect food, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's just a blanket of goodness all wrapped up and presented in a way that's easily digestible and eatable.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you travel a lot internationally and nationally?
This year, I traveled quite a bit. I've set up the shop in a way now that I have one person who's kind of running the daily stuff, like getting enough abrasives and making sure everybody knows what to do. So that allowed me to do this year for the first time.
And is traveling...
And then the kids got a little older, too.
They came with you?
No, sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is most of that professionally based, or is some of that just time to have some of that space that you need to conceptualize?
All professionally.
All
based.
Professional.
Yeah. That's one of the problems. You don't distinguish between fun and business, and then you end up doing business all the time.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Slippery slope.
It is a slippery slope, yeah. But I wouldn't want it any other way, so.
Yeah, yeah. And have you always been based out of Portland?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is your home. This is your hub.
I don't even know any other place in the U.S. I mean, well enough.
Right.
You know, I've only lived here.
Yeah. Do you feel like Portland has contributed to any component of your success or the conceptual ideas that you've brought to life?
That's a funny one. I mean, I directly probably not, like in a direct way, because... I'm not really connected to the local art scene, or I don't even have a gallery here, and I never had.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there was Linus Pauling, is from Portland, and that was the reason I made my first public piece, you know, because he was the only person to ever win two unshared Nobel Prizes. And I made these alpha helixes, which is something he proposed in 1953 or whatever, 1951. And at the same time, then I was like thinking about Douglas fir, so I was like, that's the perfect mix, you know, the Oregon state tree and this most amazing scientist who nobody knows about, that he's from Portland. So I actually found people who were interested in having a sculpture in the place where he used to live as a kid.
Wow.
Where he had his first laboratory in the basement as a 9-year-old.
Wow. Very, very
so that,
cool.
That was really kind of nice to have that.
Now, did you know him?
No, he died in 93.
Okay. So he, all right. Huh. And so that piece is in a private residence then?
No, that's on Hawthorne, on like 42nd and Hawthorne Southeast.
Okay.
Still there.
Interesting. In the transport of your pieces and installation, is that a stressful moment for you?
Not anymore. It used to be very stressful. I used to build my own crates, and I had like once like a disastrous transport where stuff like broke on the transport, but now we got really good at this.
Mm. Yeah. How do you move? I mean, how much do your pieces weigh? Some of the big installations,
You know, like those bigger ones, maybe 2-3 tons.
Uh huh.
But everything that's smaller than a truck, you can put in a crate.
Right.
And if it's bigger, then you just design it such that it doesn't exceed 102 inches wide. Then you don't need. Then you can actually do it for a decent amount of money. So that's why I made one piece that had a round base plate, and I wanted 9 feet. But I squished it a little bit in one dimension so I could just put it on a truck.
So shipping has
definitely influenced the design a lot.
I like that.
That's funny. We're talking about doing a piece up here to hold one of the larger forests that we have. And when we started getting into the dimensions of it, it was going to be 14 feet corner to corner in a cube that's turned on edge. And
that's
we were talking
bad.
About how do we, that's bad.
That's not good.
That's what we came up with as well. That's
helicopter.
That's basically not transportable at that point, right?
Right. 102 inches, the magic number for width. And then height, you can get away with pretty much 12 feet, but that's getting expensive because you need a low boy or something like that.
Right, right. And what's the farthest that you've had to transport a piece? I mean,
in the U.S.?
Yeah.
To Florida.
Florida.
I guess that's the other corner.
Farthest point.
And then otherwise, Australia, South Africa, Azerbaijan, just a piece now.
Uh-huh.
Island of Aruba, just now, too. Other Europe.
I mean, what is it? And are these pieces that are going internationally, are they pushing the limit of size?
No, they're like, you know... Like a coffin, basically.
Uh-huh.
So a little bit bigger. It's you can, you know, Azerbaijan, that was maybe two meters tall, like one, like 6 feet tall or so. Uh-huh. By this, that can fit an airplane.
Amazing. Amazing. And do you just get cold calls about these kinds of pieces and commissions?
Yes, thanks to Instagram, I do.
Wow. Mm. Wow.
That has been going on only really the last year, mm-hmm. that I have people reach out from really far away. Because that's because of the Instagram essentially has enabled these viral videos to go out in the world, and then they just have their own life.
Mm-hmm. That's incredible. Do you film your process? And
only Instagram, like Instagram story and pictures.
Yeah.
Not the whole, only the fabrication, which is sure. kind of one small part of it. I mean, the whole design work, I, of course, don't film in any ways.
That's fascinating.
It'd be kind of boring to watch, I think.
Probably. It would be fun to do a time lapse, though. I always thought I should do that, but I never did.
Yeah.
Because there's so much. It's kind of surprising. Like, it goes through so many stages with such different types of software.
Yeah.
And when you settle on a design and you're looking at creating a piece, I mean, obviously you've got to calculate the fabrication hours that are going to go into it.
Yes.
That seems like that could be a slippery slope, because if you miscalculate, it can be pretty detrimental.
Has happened.
Yeah, I bet.
Oh, yeah. 2015 was a bad year because I spent 8 months on one piece and it barely broke even. I don't think it even did.
I mean, is that part of it?
Yes. Most definitely.
And you accept that as...
Totally. Yeah.
It's life, I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's also, it teaches you to become smart, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So now I started using QuickBooks and this year I got like all into like the software that allows me to control money flow and understand it, labor being the most important there. And now I'm actually, I like to believe that I'm pretty good at it.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel a tremendous amount of pressure to make sure anything that goes out there and represents you in the world is absolutely spot on?
Yes.
And does that at times drive you over that sort of threshold that you've established for the project, just to make sure that it's right?
I don't even look at the numbers. I just do everything that's right. You know, if something is off, I get it back. I just shipped a piece back from Miami all the way here, replaced it with another piece, no questions asked, basically, because it's, you know, even Amazon can do this. And, you know, I'm like, it's like, that's the most important thing is my reputation. It's mm-hmm. like, if, you know, it's like, I try to make it as good as I can. That's just natural for me.
Is your wife still in neuroscience?
No.
No?
No, she's now doing climate activism.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So those forms that originally inspired you, are they still a point of inspiration?
Every day, because in my yard is one of those pieces.
Nice.
The early one. I don't look a whole lot at proteins anymore mm-hmm. these days. I actually did for a while. I was involved in a collaboration with scientists where we looked at using DNA as a building material that went over 4 years. So I, at that point, I was like involved in like science stuff again, but mm-hmm. right now, not much.
Do you see any of your earlier pieces and ever look at them and think, I should have done that differently?
Sure.
Yeah? Do you look at them?
Well, yeah, that's part of the process. You figure out to do stuff better.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, it's easy when you get better at stuff. It's harder to be true, you know. It's like it's kind of a strange thing. There is a certain blessing in being kind of like naive and not very good at stuff.
Right. Yeah, it's we work with a lot of ceramicists, and sometimes the earlier, cruder, a little bit more inspired and a little less technical work is maybe the most beautiful.
Yeah, that's pretty common.
Yeah. How do you guard against almost overly refining or taking yourself with the technical ability increasing, sort of losing that? It's almost like a juvenile purity to the work, you know, or like the ignorance or the unknown or that exploration of pushing the boundary and some of the lack of whatever it would be.
Yeah.
It's like there's a tangible value in that, right?
For sure. I mean, all the pieces, at least this, I mean, pretty much everything that leaves the shop right now is like at a pretty amazing degree of craftsmanship.
Mm-hmm.
And that's partly on purpose because that's actually on purpose, of course, but if I had a certain project where it would make sense to dissolve this, I would say let's use a plasma cutter and not use the laser cutter and cut it by hand. I would have no problems to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, the track it's on right now didn't really ask for that.
Yeah, sure, sure. Do you see in your future a point where you would go back to that or go back to cutting by hand for the sake of the project?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. When do you make that choice?
I'm actually thinking about right now. I've people reached out to me to make a monument to a female slave that ran away in Georgia, and it just feels the right thing to do that, to actually loosen this up quite a bit. And also, there's another person who just hired me to do an redo an old piece, and I told her I don't want to do the same thing again, but I want to kind of, here's my rough idea. I want to introduce an S-curve and basically go with it. And she was like, okay with that. So I'm there's some projects that want to capture that a little bit.
So this is coming back up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. And when you were fabricating all of the pieces yourself and now you're moving more to the computer, do you miss that tactile contact with your...
Not really.
No. So it's more about the concept than the idea that really pushes you.
I've done enough of grinding and sanding and welding. It's just, you know, at some point it's enough.
Yeah.
Let's use technology and get rid of that now.
But also, I mean, the truth is in those years, how many did I make a year? Like 2 or 3?
Sure.
You know, it's like, it's impossible. You know, this is so labor intensive, even if you make it not that perfect. It's like hundreds of hours. And then good luck trying to write those emails, you know, and trying to get the jobs.
Sure. Do you constantly have a plethora of ideas that you would love to execute, but the time and the constraints of having a studio and whatnot make that impossible?
Yes, there's a whole kind of a list of like back burner ideas, which typically tend to get pushed aside when we have a backlog of paid for pieces.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I'm kind of actually eager to wait for the next year, because right now we're all scrambling to finish up for my Art Miami.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, there will be much more time to do like stuff on spec experimentation.
Right.
Is the project you're working at Form Foundry, is that one kind of a experimentation?
Sort of. I mean, this would be, I've done that technique. I actually developed that technique using less nice 3D printing methods, but this was supposed to become pretty like perfect kind of thing, but it turns out to be a little more tricky than we thought.
Yeah.
So there's new aspects to it. I mean, it's on a different scale, which is, if you make stuff smaller, it gets a little trickier because there's a certain finite size of welding and grinding instruments. So smaller tends to be harder. And then there's also a mix of glass and 3D printed cast bronze, which is sort of new.
Yeah, pretty new. Yeah.
Cast bronze is something that's...
I've done a number of pieces now.
Uh-huh.
But it's always kind of an adventure because it requires a very different metal fabrication skill set. It's like the toolers and versus the stainless fabricators. There's kind of the two people who work in foundries, for example, who weld the sculpts in foundries. They weld it together, but they're all about tooling out the seams, basically putting this texture back in that was to connect in a way that's invisible. That's
right.
That's what their main skill is about, and stainless doesn't have that. You know, you just do welds and do a really good job in getting the stuff together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the weld is a part of it.
Yeah, exactly. And often is part of, exactly shows in the work.
Yeah,
like in my work often does.
Yeah. Those kinds of concise differences between the materials, I'm assuming those also lead to your choice of what the material is.
Yes.
And the visibility of the weld, does that lend itself to a specific style or pieces that you're making?
I like an honest weld that shows I'm a weld, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like I don't want to clean it up and pretend it's not there.
Right.
So, but that means it needs to be a certain technique. It needs to be a really good TIG weld in order to look good.
Interesting.
Wow, that's interesting. So you want the welds to be present?
In some, yes. Like, for example, where the slice is attached to the base plate to talk about this style of work, I definitely want it, yes.
Oh.
And also, the pins and the larger pieces, they have a weld on the back that gets cleaned up.
Yeah.
Because that wouldn't look good otherwise. And then on the front, there's a fusion weld around it for the bigger ones, which is also really, looks really beautiful. Again, it's like, when I talk in the shop about it, it should look like a tree root.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That buttress right at that point of the weld. I mean, there is something magical to being able to see the process or the construction of it, right?
Yeah.
And to be able to, it's almost one of the things that's always concerned me about 3D printing is losing some of those components of the process. Obviously, there are ways to preserve them and constructing the pieces, particularly on the scale and with the weight that you're working with. I would think that the process is always going to be somewhat visible. But that perfection, you know, when I was in Japan, antique Chinese ceramic containers are sort of the high mark of craftsmanship in bonsai ceramics. And one of the true tests of a really talented ceramicist is the rectangular form without the walls bowing. Because you, particularly in the antique Chinese containers, you had these long expanses of flat clay, and it's very difficult to get that clay not to bow, particularly with a fine grain of clay. You know, you can put more coarse material in there and give the clay more structure, but then all of a sudden you have this crudeness to the texture of the surface. And a lot of the antique Chinese containers is this beautiful fine clay, very fine grain, very smooth, very beautiful color and quality to it, tactile, visually. And these walls are very straight, but you could never find a wall that was perfectly straight. And that inside of seeing the wall straight but not perfectly straight was the value, right? To see that hand construction.
Exactly, yeah.
Such a difficult balance now as the you know, margins in which you see those components are shrinking as we're able to refine the process more and more. And it's like, it's interesting to hear you talking about projects where that sort of handmade, it's interesting to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, but that's an ongoing thing. You know, we've always refined technology, and it's kind of, it's like in science a little bit. We have, you know, this reductionist lens that we invented at some point, and it's been incredibly useful and wonderful and awesome, and we have iPhones. But on the other hand, we've lost certain things. We've, you know, there's an element of destruction that was introduced in the world that's haunting us now.
Right.
And so these things they're always double-edged swords, you know, just like with 3D printing. There's just the awesomeness coming up, but also we'll see, you know, what we are missing. And all the craft will be, you know, we've lost already a lot of craft.
Yeah.
And that's kind of an ongoing process.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah. Is there a dialogue between you and your wife about the sustainability of art and work, since she's really working hard to advocate for environmentalism?
We talk a lot about sustainability,
yeah,
whatever that means, yeah. But in, you know, I'm metalwork is does have a pretty oversized footprint.
I mean, one of the original team members was talking about just, you know, the production of paper, if you're drawing, the creation of paint pigmentation or, you know, canvas or anything. It's almost like every medium that we utilize in the built world has a very large footprint. And it is interesting to wrestle with, because then you start to talk about what is the value of art. And I still do firmly believe that it is necessary, absolutely necessary, to create that dialogue or expand and explore those ideas, and for people to be able to digest that and look at it, enjoy it, tap into the concepts, be inspired by it, connect, whatever the purpose of the piece is. But Lime was talking about ceramics and how in the carbon catalog? The fossil record.
Fossil records.
There's no documented history of a bonsai container until now. You know, the fossil record. Yeah, our conversation was that's because people were too busy trying to eat and survive, and now we're at this point where.
Yeah, but then again, they made sculptures already a long time ago.
Right.
35,000 years ago are the earliest human figurines.
Right.
So it's quite a while.
Yeah, yeah, and even
that we know of. There could be a lot older.
That's true.
Yeah, who knows?
Even they were talking about the original, sort of the original most archaic tool that, that was found was a very functional tool, but also started to employ design and gain some sort of indicator of social status or prominence in this very archaic tool. And it gained this level of craftsmanship and design very quickly in its history when it's carbon dated. And so you see design and whether that's art, and they've pretty much identified at least that it wasn't a functional component that created that evolution. It was in fact an aesthetic component. It's very interesting. It's almost like we're programmed for that.
Yeah, but that's, I mean, no coincidence, right? It's like what you're talking about in the beginning about the Fibonacci sequences, and we are hardwired to find them beautiful. I mean, there's very deep mathematical, if you will, reasons for that. You know, it's not a coincidence that, that we feel that way. It's like those are deeply connected, I think, form and function.
It's overwhelming for me to try and think about that, honestly. Just the fact that we are programmed, or we carry that somewhere inside of us as a species. Where? Why? I struggle with that immensely. Yeah, it bothers me.
I mean, if you look at like energy minimization, if you're a big animal and you want to walk in a way that's not totally wasteful, you know, you find that the most, it's an elegant gait you're assuming because that's the most energy efficient.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's like this. You have like, you know, or you have I mean, there's so many examples like the Fibonacci numbers you mentioned. There's the pine cones. You know, it's you have a simple law that leads to them. And how can you encode a simple law in optimizing, for example, the sunflower seed density and stuff like that? I guess I can't really put it well in words, but I always thought I felt this kind of convincing, but maybe I just didn't really think about it deep enough.
Well, and I mean, it makes sense organizationally. I mean, any environment, it takes organization to coexist, it seems to me. And so it makes sense. It also increases efficiency. Organization does. Spatial efficiency, resource efficiency, distribution efficiency. I mean, you could take it from the sunflower seeds to the distribution of the seeds out of a pine cone, the formation in terms of vascular division to create that pine cone. And I see that. Why then are human beings striving for design? Why did making it look more beautiful? And your discussion about the gait of an animal, the most efficient gait being a more elegant gait, and this is more visually attractive as well as more efficient for the movement of the animal. But making a club look more attractive as a aesthetic discussion in a societal, and maybe it comes back to the organizational thing. Maybe that's what created the organization and hierarchy in that particular subset of a species. And that was the object that occurred. I don't know, but this is where it becomes very curious to me.
It is curious.
Yeah, because it loses when you, whatever does set us apart, whether it is the ability to reason or not, I mean, that seems to be sort of a broad brushstroke differentiation of the human species to the other mammals on Earth. That ability to reason, a gift and a curse, and also inside of the ability to reason, to add more labor to a functional item is not really reasonable. Outside of just enjoying the fact that it looks nicer, you know what I'm saying? I mean, there is a lot of form and function, and then there's art, which is laborious, painstaking communication of whatever the idea, concept, or dialogue is about that piece. And ultimately, a lot of artists spend their life in I would say, you know, not awesome economic circumstances to have that voice that they feel so compelled to, and to create these pieces where when it's put out into the public, you're not even sure people are understanding the story or the purpose of that or the reason behind it. And all of those, when you tie them all together, it starts to become a very curious thing, yet we're compelled to continue doing so. Yeah. And it's just...
It is weird, you're right.
Yeah, it's It literally breaks my brain to try and ultimately there's never going to, I don't think there's ever going to be an answer. I don't think there's a lot of unanswerable, obviously a lot greater unanswerable questions that exist, but it seems an unexplained, you know, and with the addition of, you know, artificial intelligence and all of the questions that surround, you know, what is life and sort of autonomy of intelligence and all of that, those questions are broadening in terms of their applicability and appropriateness and maybe the range and depth at which they can be explored. And I think we are in a major period with the onset of a lot of this technology that's enabling these things to be further explored and tampered with and understood. Dangerous, yes. Fascinating, absolutely. And it's sort of that, you know, art is necessary. It has a carbon footprint. It's like the yin and the yang. Mm. One of the things I experienced in Japan as when I was apprenticing with my master was that in Japan, in that culture, there was never a good without a bad and never a bad without a good. And that is not something that I experience on a daily basis in the Western world. You know, there is a good and there's only a good, or at least I think that's the interpretation of a lot of good or a lot of bad. But it was a definitive, and I don't know where that came from. That feeling came from when I was there in that culture apprenticing, but it was very significant, that feeling that I was successful with a piece of work he had given me, but also he corrected a large portion of it and there was something to learn from it. I let a bird eat all the berries off of a tree that was going to an exhibition, and yet I learned a new technique to be able to preserve that tree in that particular instance. I tore a branch off of a tree. He restyled it and it became even better, but you never could have cut that branch off without it being torn off accidentally. You know, it's just like that constant, this constant push-pull, and maybe it's a cultural thing. Maybe, I don't know. I wonder that a lot too. It's these sort of unanswered questions and differences of perspective. So it's been a little overwhelming to think about it all.
But the yin-yang, it's life, I guess. We don't think about it here. Everyone wants everything without cost.
Yeah, I wonder if it's culturally associated. Do you feel like your background and growing up in Germany influences your work?
Yes, definitely.
How so?
It's complicated. I mean, one eye-opening thing was I read this book called something like Art and Mathematics. The Exploring the Invisible or something like this, about art and science. And it was so clear that talked about the whole culture, that this was like such an important element in German kind of culture over the last, I don't know, even several centuries. And I just didn't realize that.
Mm.
And I thought it was really intriguing, you know, to see that I'm kind of like a new generation of something that has been going on, and I just didn't even realize that.
Yeah.
You know, that I felt definitely. Then I sometimes a little bit, I read like old poetry in German, and like Goethe and Lessing or Schiller, and I feel so, especially after these many years here in this very different world, I suddenly have this sense that this is so close, you know, to my heart. Or the music, you know, the old music, like if I listen to the Bach and Beethoven and Schubert and stuff like this, there's something in there that's just like incredibly close to who I am.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. I can't take it out of the human.
No, who knows? I mean, we always think, oh, there's genetics and then there's culture. I always wonder if we're not maybe missing like one big chunk there, you know, that there's some like a karmic, spiritual kind of like karmic, maybe
yeah.
That's really the word, like a dynamic or like an aspect that we just don't capture with these two extremes.
Right. Right.
Or that
if you
we,
look, yeah.
That we can tangibly, we can't calculate it yet. Math hasn't taken us there, but.
Well, we don't have the language coming from the Western. You know, we are children of the Enlightenment and the Renaissance, and we have this kind of this Descartesian view that there's like life and not life and soul and body, and that the deeply classical reductionist view of seeing the world as the reality out there is independent of us, and it's this thing that happens. you know, completely, basically, in quantum physics, we see that this is false. Mm-hmm. You know, and if we see in the Eastern kind of traditional wisdom kind of traditions that have very different views about that. And I think it's really time to kind of come together as a human species to kind of like reconnect the dots and kind of understand that we had to go through reductionism and we will have to eventually embrace a holistic kind of view again. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I feel this very strongly. And we have such, you mentioned these challenges, artificial intelligence, pollution. Our power has gotten so big that we are on a global scale now. We can just wipe out everything. We're not the innocent kids we used to be, that we could just make mistakes and the genocide here, the kingdom destroyed there. That's over. You know, now it's like it's all or nothing, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, unified despite a lack of unity, we are codependent now on each other on a global scale.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's painful to see how, with what bullshit politics is dealing every day instead of tackling all these really, really urgent questions.
Right. Right. Yeah. Phenomenal mess. You know, ultimately a phenomenal mess. And when I was in, I had the opportunity to travel to Israel earlier this year, and I worked in Jerusalem. In Tel Aviv, and being there, one of the things that came to mind is when you look at all of the conflict that's occurred there over, you know, tens of thousands of years, thousands of years, maybe tens of thousands of years, depending on how you view history. I couldn't help but wonder what single point or what single root event, probably small. Maybe a disagreement amongst people, maybe a misunderstood gesture. At the very base origin of it, some point in humanity created this, you know, you talk about sort of the very small move at the base of an angle. And the longer that those lines extend, the farther away those points become. But there's always an origin to those lines, and it was at once unified. And so when you start to look at that growing gap, that it's like, what piece, what point, what action, what event, what misspoken word, misunderstood gesture started this enormity, this immensity of conflict in this very pivotal region of the world, this very tiny country. I mean, it's Israel is tiny, and it's the epicenter of so much difference of opinion and thought and religious foundation, right? And it was looking at the old city and sort of the more modern city and staring at the wall that divides Israel and Palestine. And it was a fascinating experience to be there and to think that.
If you read like Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel, for example, do you know that book?
I don't. I haven't read that.
It's been a while, but one of the take-home messages for me was that civilization, you know, it started around that area there. So basically they grew and were very successful and then became a locally victim of their own success and kind of depleted the resources and kind of trashed the place, basically. Mm-hmm. And that happened then, you know, in Greece, and then essentially it moved towards like Rome and to the north and to the west and kind of and then... the rest is like industrial revolution around England. So there is these differences. You see it in your family, you know, you yell at each other, but it's all good as long as we're not kind of, I think, as long as there's a substrate to have everybody have their happiness, you know. Mm-hmm. But if when stuff gets complicated, like when there's no more food, for example, or no more water, then these things explode.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what we're looking at often in the world.
Yeah, coming to that climactic point potentially. And it's being in a first world country and making bonsai pots, which have never had a purpose until now. You do look at it, and there's a lot of places in the world that have hit that climactic point or are hitting that climactic point or have existed in that level of conflict for forever and will continue to. And it's just like, oh man,
how do you
close the gap and sort of minimize the distance between the two points that's been growing for so long?
Yeah. I think it's especially important here in the Pacific Northwest, or in the US maybe in general. We are like in the midst of an explosion into nature, you know? Like just look at Portland 10 years ago.
Yep.
And that's that provides us with a certain luxury. You think we can take this for granted, but it's not at all, you know?
Right.
If you look down south, like even in Northern California, I mean, there's the wildfires and the wells have been dropping, even Southern Oregon. So it's just like it's creeping up, you know?
Yep. Yeah, originally I was going to create my facility outside of Sacramento, California, in the foothills on the way to Tahoe, and I had to make a decision, and I recognized that water wasn't going to get more plentiful, and the temperatures weren't going to get lower. Right. And so I recognized that I needed to go farther north, and summers here are hotter and drier.
Mountain.
What's that?
Next to a mountain, too, because that's where the water comes from.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But I mean... you know, there's a lot of cedars on site here at Mirai that are dying, the big trees that are dying. And there's a lot of plant physiologists who are saying it's a result of a root-borne pathogen. But those root-borne pathogens, if you really dig into the history of them, most of them have been here and will continue to be here. And ultimately, it's the susceptibility to the changing of water levels, which decrease the productivity of the stress response hormones and resources that allow a tree to endure and cope. And so even here, it's touching one of the last great places, at least in the United States portion of North America, where rain and water is abundant.
Yeah.
It's going to be
worrisome.
Worrisome, and who knows?
And we do. It's funny for me because in societies we see it like wherever we look, it's basically we are undermining our resilience, kind of everywhere in the plant world, in the human world. You know, and that's a really dangerous path to be on.
Yeah. Fascinating to consider it all, and also. The other curiosity that kind of arises when we start thinking about this is to look at Egypt and some of those really evolved ancient cultures and to not truly understand what did happen, how long they were in existence. There's a lot of discoveries now with modern science that suggests that they may have been around a lot longer than we had thought and proposed, not verified and validated by the, you know, the scientific method that we kind of abide by to accept that as knowledge, but the potential for it as we learn more and certain figures being able to interpret the hieroglyphs at a deeper level with a more concise information that they can derive from them. And all of a sudden there's potential, you know, the pyramids were built on top of structures that existed long before the pyramids ever did. And then all of a sudden you get into this, well, where did they come from and how did they get there? And oh my gosh, your head explodes. but also what knowledge left with them, what knowledge is sitting there that we don't have the language, much like you kind of talked about in terms of being able to quantify that karma or whatever that component that we could be missing. What is the language that information is existing in that we can't speak anymore or haven't learned how to speak yet? It's just too much. Well, I want to be respectful of your time. But I very, very, very much appreciate you coming and hanging with us this morning.
It was fun.
And I don't know if you would be up for it. I would love to come and see where you guys work at some point. If that would be possible. I know Lyme and Rob are good buddies, and Rob has nothing but incredible things to say about you, and your work is incredible. I would love to. I went and experienced The Reader, and thought it was amazing to sit in front of it. That's kind of where the dialogue about how do you feel about people forming their own opinion of your work, void of context. But I would love that if you're up for it.
Yeah.
Very cool. Right on.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us at Mirai. If you have a moment, walk around the garden. I'd love to share that with you.
Excellent.
Cool. Thanks.
Thank you.